This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 25, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Tens of thousands of protesters march for the immediate removal of Philippines President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. On Capitol Hill, the House and Senate paved the way to transform the nation's energy policy. And Latin America launches a historic media collaboration. We'll hear the sounds of Telesur. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Egyptian police are now searching for six Pakistanis in connection with Saturday's bombing of the Sharm el-Sheikh resort in the Sinai Peninsula. The explosion killed 88 people, including 17 foreigners. Paul Shem reports from Cairo.
If the Pakistanis, who are believed to be in their 20s and 30s, are really involved in the attacks, this would represent one of the first times foreigners have committed terrorist acts on Egyptian soil. It would also suggest connections with an international terrorist network. Police are also pursuing the possibility that a Sinai-based militant group that was responsible for the October 2004 bombings in the Sinai town of Taba is also involved in the Sharm el-Sheikh attacks. Already over 70 people in the surrounding area have been taken in for questioning. Following the October attacks, thousands of Sinai residents were rounded up by police and remain in custody without charge, while a manhunt was mounted for the several suspects still at large, which has still proven unsuccessful. The attacks are expected to have a serious effect on Egypt's tourism industry, the country's largest earner of foreign currency. Some 2 million people are employed in the industry, and many in Sharm el-Sheikh are expecting layoffs. This is Paul Shem in Cairo with Free Speech Radio News.
The leaders of two of the AFL-CIO's largest unions, the Teamsters and the Service Employees, have officially announced that they are leaving the Labor Federation. Other unions that have joined the dissident Change the Wind Coalition may follow suit later this week during the AFL's 50th anniversary convention in Chicago. Chris Giovannis reports.
AFL-CIO loyalists have characterized the split as a power grab with devastating consequences for the labor movement. Change to Win spokespeople say the split stems from failed negotiations to reform the AFL and will help unions grow over the long term. The Change to Win coalition's demands included replacing AFL-CIO President John Sweeney with their candidate, more direct control over their members' AFL-CIO dues, and the ability to force smaller unions to merge. Not all of the Change to Win unions are happy with the split, and some SEIU locals are reportedly considering leaving their international out of concern that they've not been consulted about abandoning the AFL-CIO. In Chicago, this is Chris Giovannis of Chicago Indie Media for Free Speech Radio News.
Tea workers in India are close to reaching a compromise in a massive tea strike. They have agreed on their most pertinent issue, a pay raise. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
Pending a final decision, a breakthrough is reported to have been reached between the striking tea workers and the estate owners in the Indian state of West Bengal. The wage rise of rupees 2 per day, or equal to 5 cents, is agreed upon for the next 2 years, after which there will be a revision. The agreement is likely to end the strike by nearly 500,000 tea laborers that started July 10th. A $2.3 million daily loss was reported due to the strike, since along with Assam state, West Bengal accounted for nearly 85% of country's total tea output. But some other issues, like whether the rise would have a retrospective effect, and also the issues relating to insurance and medical facilities, are yet to be resolved. From Ahmedabad in India, Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Police in Indian-administered Kashmir detained at least 20 protesters on Monday as hundreds of angry demonstrations took place for the second day against the killings of three innocent teenagers on Saturday night by the Indian troops. Shahnawaz Khan has more from Srinagar, Kashmir.
The three boys were killed in the Kupwara district of Indian-administered Kashmir when the Indian security forces mistook them for militants. Police sources say the four youth were strolling outside a house in a village near Handwara town where they had gone to attend a wedding. Indian troops had laid an ambush in the area to intercept militants and fired at the youths, killing two of them and wounding the other two. One of the injured succumbed to his injuries later. The Indian Army called the incident regrettable, but added the boys ignored restrictions on people going outside after dark. Jammu and Kashmir Chief Minister Mufti Muhammad Saeed has ordered an investigation into the incident, something people in Kashmir say is a face-saving routine after the human rights violations by the troops. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
Kofi Annan announced that he will visit the destroyed villages in Zimbabwe. He says Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe invited him to visit. The invitation comes after a UN report found that the demolition project violated international law, a report Mugabe dismisses. More than 700,000 people have lost their homes in the destruction of slums, known as Operation Murambatsvina, or Operation Drive Out Rubbish. Supreme Court nominee John Roberts is listed in the leadership directory of the conservative legal association, the Federalist Society. In 1997 to 1998, he is listed as a member of the steering committee. He has declined to comment, and the White House denies his affiliation. Alfred Roth, president of the Institute for Democracy Studies in New York, says that the Senate should investigate his role during his nomination process.
One can only hope that people ask the members of the Judiciary Committee to explore with some degree of rigor exactly what the agenda of the Federalist Society is.
The Federalist Society was created in 1983 in opposition to the left-leaning teachings in law schools. They have opposed issues such as affirmative action and the basic principles of a habeas corpus. I'm Leanne Caldwell at WPFW in Washington, D.C. About 20,000 demonstrators took to the streets in Manila today, demanding the immediate removal of Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, the latest in a wave of demonstrations against her for the past few weeks. In a nearly one-hour-long speech, Arroyo called for the overhaul of the country's political system to ease a crisis sparked by vote-rigging allegations against her. Meanwhile, in Congress, formal impeachment hearings against Arroyo may take longer than expected, as opposition fell short of the votes needed in the House to impeach her. In Manila, Gurley Linao reports.
For almost 1 hour today, President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo beamed as allies applauded loudly and chanted her name during her State of the Nation address in Congress. The rousing sign of support was a respite for the embattled leader, who has faced daily street protests and mounting calls to resign since June due to allegations she cheated in last year's elections. The applause became louder when Arroyo urged Congress to amend the country's constitution to shift to a parliamentary form of government from the current presidential system.
Our political system has degenerated to the extent that it's difficult for anyone to make any headway yet keep his hands clean. Perhaps we have strained the present political system to its final limit. The system clearly needs fundamental change, and the sooner, the better. It's time to start the great debate on charter change.
Arroyo's allies hailed her decision to back the proposal to change the form of government, which they have been pushing for the past weeks as the best way out of the crisis. Her speech, however, fell short of what many Filipinos wanted to hear, and even some members of her political party expressed disappointment. Senator Pia Cayetano, who ran under Arroyo's ticket last year, noted that the country was facing many problems that could not be solved simply by a change in the political system.
I'm not happy that we are going to spend a great amount of time to change our political system, which did not seem to cause that many problems 6 months ago. I think there is something wrong if we will now say, let us change the political system and all our problems will be solved, because that is kind of the message I hear. And I'd like to think that that is not the message that she intended to send.
For critics, the only acceptable solution is still Arroyo's removal from office. Hours before her State of the Nation address, opposition lawmakers filed an impeachment complaint against Arroyo, accusing her of cheating, lying, and stealing. 40 members of the House of Representatives endorsed the complaint, but the opposition needs to convince 39 more lawmakers to sign it before a trial can commence. Outside the halls of Congress, about 40,000 people joined a rally against Arroyo as she delivered her speech. The demonstrators vowed to hold more street protests until the president heeded their call to resign. But their cries were absent from the television broadcasts of the deafening cheers that Arroyo received inside. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linao in Manila.
London police are defending their shoot-to-kill policy following Friday's fatal shooting of an innocent Brazilian man on London's transit network. The killing has raised concerns about police procedures in the hunt for suspected suicide bombers and increased fears that ethnic communities may become the target of police intimidation and harassment. FSRN's Helen Kelly reports.
The mood in London remains tense today as around 3,000 armed police continue the hunt for the men who attempted to blow up three tube trains and a bus last Thursday. A total of five people have now been arrested in connection with the attempted bombings, and the police have named two suspects. Peter Clark, head of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist branch, identified those suspects.
We now believe the man on the bus who attempted to set off that bomb to be Mukhtar Saeed Ibrahim, also known as Mukhtar Mohammed Saeed. We believe this man to be Yasin Hassan Omar. He is 24 years old.
There is also speculation about a fifth bomber following the discovery of a backpack containing a device in a West London park on Saturday. Police carried out a controlled explosion on the package, which they say appeared to be of a similar design to those used on Thursday, containing explosives, nails and shrapnel. Meanwhile, it has emerged that Brazilian Jean Charles de Menezes, who was killed by police at Stockwell tube station on Friday, was completely unconnected to the attempted bombings. The 27-year-old Brazilian man had come to the UK on a student visa and had been in the capital for 3 years working as an electrician. Met Police Chief Sir Ian Blair has apologised to Mr. Menezes' family, accepting full responsibility for the accident and calling it a tragedy. But Sir Ian insisted in an interview with the BBC that the policy of shoot to kill would continue and warned that more innocent victims may be killed as a result.
There's no point in shooting at somebody's chest because they might, that's where the bomb's likely to be. There's no point in shooting anywhere else because if they fall down, if they detonate it.
The Muslim Association of Britain has called for a review of police policy on apprehending suspects after the shooting of Mr. Menezes. Dr. Azam Tamimi from the Muslim Association of Britain said the shooting has worried the Islamic community, which fears that it could become the target of overzealous policing.
The killing of this innocent Brazilian young man has instilled more horror in the hearts of people now, simply because people don't know if they are likely to be suspected of being potential terrorists. The qualification for being a terrorist would seem is that you look foreigner, you look alien, and that's very dangerous.
Meanwhile, a conference organised by an Islamic charity on Sunday was targeted by members of the National Front, who stage a protest near the Central Mosque in Regent's Park, central London. About 20 members of the far-right organisation waved banners and chanted obscenities. The Met Police-sponsored conference was designed to educate young British Muslims about extremism and Islamophobia, and called on the public and media to work more closely with the Muslim community to fight extremism. This is Helen Kelly reporting from London for Free Speech Radio News.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Archives of our program are available on the web at fsrn.org. On Capitol Hill, Senate and House negotiators agreed to strip the controversial MTBE liability protection out of the energy bill, thus clearing the way for a full congressional vote on the bill to transform the nation's energy policy that has been continually blocked for the past 5 years. In previous years, the energy bill was blocked in part to the MTBE provision that would shield manufacturers of the gasoline additive from lawsuits, as MTBE has contaminated fresh water reserves throughout the country. The energy bill would still spur the construction of new nuclear plants and further deregulate the energy industry while offering the industry billions of dollars in subsidies. Today, Native American activists went to Capitol Hill to urge Senate Democrats to block the bill once again, saying that the reservations are being targeted to dump the radioactive waste from the nuclear power plants. On Capitol Hill, Mitch Jezerich has more.
In Utah, just 45 minutes from Salt Lake City, the School Valley Reservation is home to the School Valley Goshute Indians. However, depending on an expected decision within the next few days from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the area could become home to tens of thousands of tons of radioactive atomic fuel from commercial reactors. A private group made up of seven electric utility companies known as the Private Fuel Storage gave millions of dollars to the tribal chair, Leon Baer, to dump about 80% of the country's radioactive waste into the reservation. Leon Baer has been indicted for allegedly pocketing most of the money and refusing to share with members who oppose the plan.
He has been indicted, convicted, did a plea bargain. But he refuses to step down.
Marjorie Bull Creek of the School Valley Goshutes has come to Washington, D.C. to try to convince the government not to allow nuclear waste to be dumped into the land that she lives on. She is also attempting to meet with lawmakers to encourage them to vote against Bush administration's energy bill, which could get final congressional approval this week. The bill would attempt to revitalize the nation's nuclear energy industry. Because of tribal sovereignty, which is not subjected to state and federal environmental laws, tribal lands have been sought after areas to dump radioactive waste. For Bull Creek, it's nothing more than environmental racism.
There's no other place to put this high-level nuclear waste. Nobody wants it. And so they want to put it on our small reservation because of our sovereignty issue, and there's not that much questionable ethics to bring up.
The energy bill has its impetus from Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force. Cheney has refused to make public the task force documents that might indicate who was involved in the development of the administration's energy policy. One known participant was ex-Enron executive Ken Lay. George Bush has been trying to get this bill on his desk since the beginning of his presidency.
Now's the time to stop the debate and the partisan bickering and pass an energy bill.
This week may be Bush's best shot at getting his energy bill. Reportedly, the energy bill would offer between $7 to $10 billion in incentives to build nuclear power plants. Kevin Camps is with the Nuclear Information and Resource Services.
This is a full-blown effort by the Bush administration to revive nuclear power in the United States. There hasn't been a reactor order actually built in the United States for over 30 years. It was October of 1973. So they think if they throw enough taxpayer money at this, that they're going to be able to build reactors. But there's going to be, as soon as the reactor sites are announced, there's going to be a groundswell of opposition. We're already seeing that in places like central Illinois, right here in Virginia nearby, and down in Mississippi. There are new organizations forming, and it's just like the 1970s when huge protest movements fought nuclear power plants.
Incentives in the energy bill towards nuclear energy development include loan guarantees, tax breaks, and limited liability in the case of an accident which Kevin Camp says could result in the deaths of thousands.
The reactor core contains so much radioactivity that tens of thousands of people downwind could die from radiation poisoning alone, and then latent cancer fatalities over time could kill tens of thousands of more. And these are not numbers I'm making up out of thin air. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself and the Atomic Energy Commission before that put out reports that they suppressed. They did reports that they didn't release to the public until it was forced out, showing that these huge casualty numbers are possible. And Chernobyl started to show what those casualties could be.
The Senate and House are expected to place their final vote on the energy bill this week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
15 Sunni members of Iraq's Constitution Committee said today that they will return to the bargaining table to finish their work on the draft constitution. Sunnis pulled out of negotiations last week due to security concerns after one of their members was assassinated. David Enders interviews Humam Hammoudi, the head of Iraq's Constitution Committee.
The assassination of two Sunni members of the 70 persons tasked with drafting a new Iraqi constitution threatened to derail the process, but Sunnis on the committee today met with members of the government to demand an international investigation into the assassinations, to which the government agreed. The promise of the return of the Sunnis to negotiations, however, does not solve all of the problems with drafting the new constitution, the most serious being an argument over what degree of autonomy Iraq's 18 governorates will have. Hammoudi says that despite the disagreements, he expects the constitution will be finished by August 15th. The committee has until August 1st to request a six-month extension for their work, and Hammoudi said he envisions there will be many calls for amendments if the document is ratified.
Thanks to God, the Sunnis are coming back. There are lots of things that we need to discuss, especially the federalism. We hope to make some decisions, but even the American Constitution has been changed many times.
Hammoudi says the problem of federalism has come down to a disagreement between Sunni and Kurdish members of the council. The Kurds favor keeping the Baghdad government out of what already amounts to an autonomous Kurdish state in the north, and the Sunnis favor a strong, centralized government.
The Kurds would like the highest level of federalism, and the Sunnis are against this. This is the biggest problem we are facing. We hope we can reach a compromise between them.
Kurdish members of the council have demanded that the constitution set new boundaries for the autonomous area, further south than the current ones. But Hammoudi says any redrawing of what is considered Kurdish territory would be put off until after the constitution is written and the next round of elections have been held.
This problem needs to be solved after the constitution and after the elections, because it has to be given a timetable and discussion.
The country's Sunni minority, many feeling disenfranchised by the Shia and Kurdish-dominated government, are aware that in the nationwide referendum expected to be held in October on whatever draft the committee produces, only 3 of the 18 provinces have to vote against ratification for the document to fail. Sunni leaders have threatened to encourage their constituents to do as much if they are not satisfied with the document.
It's better for the Sunnis to have a constitution that is written by Iraqis in their hands, written with Islam and written with Arabs. It is much better than a constitution that is written by Americans.
Other issues that remain unsettled are whether Iraq will be referred to as an Islamic Republic and whether it will be considered part of the Arab nation, a title to which the Kurds are opposed. Hammoudi, a Shiite cleric, and many other members of the committee are also close to Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, and the extent to which Islam will play a part in the new constitution has been a sticking point. But Hammoudi said Iraqis would be given a choice of subscribing to Islamic or civil law, and that the constitution would protect freedom of worship.
They will not be allowed to make laws against Islam like in Turkey, where they banned the headscarf, nor will it be like Iran, where they put the legislation to the people.
Some women on the Constitution Committee have requested an article specifically safeguarding women's rights, but Hammoudi says such an article is not needed.
On the contrary, the women have their rights, economically and politically. The first woman who led a political demonstration was the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad, and the first martyr against Saddam Hussein was a woman.
Despite Hammoudi's assertions, committee members say many concerns remain. Also unsettled is the form which Iraq's next elections will take, and whether executives will be directly elected. Hammoudi did say that the current consensus has members of parliament being elected on a governorate-by-governorate basis, which Sunni members had argued strongly for. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Brother Cornel West, I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays better truth and inspires you to fight for justice. Free Speech Radio News.
This weekend saw the launch of a historic television collaboration in the Americas. The new network that ESUR has been in the works for 6 years and is a collaboration of several Caribbean, Central, and South American nations. Venezuela, Argentina, Cuba, and Uruguay put up the money to fund what is touted to be the Al Jazeera of the South. The U.S. government, meanwhile, has sought permission from Congress to jam Telesur's signal with propaganda-style programming. However, in Telesur's main hub, Caracas, U.S. threats were brushed off as celebrations of the new network took place yesterday. Pacifica's Deepa Fernandez and Christopher Sprinkle were there and bring us this montage of Telesur.
Buenos Aires, Brasilia, Montevideo, Ciudad de México, Bogotá, La Habana, La Paz, Washington. Una red de colaboradores en todo el continente.
Un equipo latinoamericano de periodistas y productores en Caracas.
Una agenda propia, la de América Latina.
Telesur is then launching or conveying a clear projection of breaking that international communication order and to present a new vision a new voice that so far had been silent. In this fashion, Telesur is an initiative against cultural imperialism and in general against imperialism in any of its ways. This shouldn't be interpreted, however, as an initiative against the Jewish people, as some people has already said. Domination through communication. Domination through communication. So Telesur is trying to foster debates and find answers about the reasons of our enormous foreign debt, which day after day is more burdensome and more criminal.
This is why we have said that we are not neutral. How can you be neutral in the midst of an oppressed person and domination? We can't be that kind of journalist that goes to an armed conflict or a war site and facing someone dying in front of them, they don't cry. We do sometimes watching our own pieces, we cry. And when we put the news on, that shows we are not objective. We're proud of that. We want to rescue subjectivity and revindicate that humanity. If we didn't feel so deeply linked, connected to the real people, indigenous people, people born and raised in Latin America who love Latin America, if we didn't feel identified with those people, we wouldn't be here, and Telesur would not be what it is today.
Finally, when we're talking about challenging neoliberal elites, why media? Why not take on the economic systems or the financial burdens that are imposed on this country? Why media?
Well, I think they will take all that on, but it's a way they will challenge the dominant view provided by the media, which is owned by corporate elites or acts in their interest.
En Telesur, los latinoamericanos nos vemos las caras con ojos propios.
Danny Glover, tell us how you're feeling today on the launch of Telesur.
Well, I'm certainly excited, you know, not only for the people of Latin America and the possibilities of having their voice and identities clarified and another understanding, another truth brought to the world. But I'm also excited for how this could be replicated in ways that we could duplicate it in other places. We'll learn something from this experience. We, who are progressive forces in the United States, will learn something from this experience.
Thanks to Pacifica's Deepa Fernandez and Christopher Sprinkle for the montage featuring voices from this weekend's launch of Telesur. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Our headlines editor is Leanne Caldwell. Mitch Jezerich is our Washington editor. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, McMillan, and Eric Klein. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, please visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.